Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, October 18th. I'm Ray Graff. Support for Medical Monday comes from Saratoga Hospital, welcoming Dr. Jennifer Bayron to their breast care team, joining Dr. Patricia Ray Kennedy at the Saratoga Hospital Center for Breast Care on their Wilton campus, saratogahospital.org. Joining us this afternoon to talk about sleep disorders is Dr. Boris Medaroff, the medical director of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. We'll talk about diagnosing sleep disorders, the dangers of chronic sleep deprivation, and the state-of-the-art treatments. And if you have a question, call early. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Boris Medaroff and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Why do we sleep? Seems like a simple question, but actually there are many theories about that. Whatever that reason is, the science is clear. We all need good sleep, and for some of us, it's not as easy as it should be. In the studio today to discuss sleep disorders is Dr. Boris Medaroff. Dr. Medaroff is medical director of Albany Med's Sleep Clinic, where he evaluates patients with sleep complaints and diagnoses and treats sleep disorders. If you have a question for Dr. Medaroff, give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. You can email us as well at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number, this is a call-in show, 800-348-2551. Dr. Boris Medaroff, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. I read that an estimated 70 million Americans have sleep disorders. That's a lot of people. That's a great deal of our population, either in some state of walking around dazed or just needing a good nap. How many types of disorders, sleep disorders, are there?
It is an astonishing number. You're absolutely right. There are many sleep disorders that can affect us. As you mentioned, why we sleep, it may not be necessarily clear, but we all know we need a good night's sleep. The most common sleep disorder would probably be insomnia, inability to fall asleep. Up to 30% of people experience severe insomnia at some point of their life. And depending on which estimates you look at, up to 15% of people suffer of insomnia on a regular basis.
When you say severe insomnia, this is something I can't fathom. I've always been able to just drop and fall asleep. How severe is severe insomnia, and why does it happen?
Well, consider yourself lucky, because it is a common problem, as I mentioned. Once it starts interfering with one's ability to function, fulfill their responsibilities, work, studies, school, we consider it a real problem.
But besides stimulants, nicotine, caffeine, things like that, do we have a physiological reason why some people just can't get to sleep?
Well, very good question. There are many reasons, and as it is the case with many other disorders, quite often we consider it idiopathic, basically meaning we don't know what the reason behind is. A lot of our proclivity to insomnia is probably based in the fact that in modern society, we don't live the way our body has been designed to function. A lot of stress, a specific schedule when we need to wake up, when we need to go to work. If our work involves working at night, this is not natural to our body to do that. Insomnia was probably not something cavemen had to face.
Doctors have to face it. And you went to med school. There must have been many a sleepless night. How many doctors have insomnia?
Well, I wouldn't know the exact number, but it is a common problem. And I want to point out that insufficient sleep is not the same thing as insomnia. Insufficient sleep is also a common issue in today's life. But insomnia is basically difficulties falling asleep or difficulties maintaining sleep. And interestingly enough, it may sound counterintuitive to most people. People who suffer of insomnia are not necessarily sleepy. If you try to fall asleep, assuming you're a chronic insomnia sufferer, during the day, you may not be able to. Most people are not. Their level of arousal, if you will, is actually higher than the people who have normal sleep. They do feel sleepy, or at least objectively. Fatigue, lassitude, lack of energy is very common, and this is what affects those people. But if you offer them to take a nap at 2 p.m., a lot of them would not be able to do. This is the paradox of insomnia.
We're joined today by Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med's Sleep Clinic on the sleep programs that we have done over the years. Oftentimes, and we'll get to this today, we talk about apnea as being a biggie. And I know from experience, apnea can really be a thing where you suddenly you find yourself falling asleep for no reason. In attacking apnea, is there a way other than the traditional CPAP machine that is really effective with outcomes?
So obstructive sleep apnea is indeed a common issue, probably the second most common, depending on which demographics we look at after insomnia. To answer your question, there are other treatment modalities besides CPAP. Not many of them have the effectiveness and the non-invasive nature as CPAP does. There are surgical procedures that can be done for sleep apnea. There are what we call oral appliances, small devices that people wear at night that look like a mouth guard, which in relatively mild or moderate cases may be sufficient to treat sleep apnea. There is the Inspire system, which is a pacemaker-like device that gets implanted under the skin, which paces some neck muscles, and in selected cases that can be effective in treating sleep apnea.
Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest today on Vox Pop, and we will get to your calls very shortly. The number here is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. We know about insomnia. We know about apnea. What are some of the other, there must be dozens of sleep disorders that we don't hear about on a regular basis?
There are a lot of sleep disorders. To mention one that people hear about, although it's very uncommon, that's narcolepsy. It's a sleep disorder that involves intrusion of REM sleep into the wakefulness state, and those people are very often depicted in movies as extremely sleepy and falling asleep while eating their soup. It's probably not very common in real life to see that degree of sleepiness, but sleepiness is very common in narcolepsy and can affect those people's lives. They often suffer of what we call cataplexy, which is a sudden drop of muscle tone in various muscle groups, and in some cases may be severe enough that people would drop on the floor. That's usually triggered by emotional states, by being scared or laughing or happy, hearing a joke. It's a very peculiar disorder that thankfully is not very common, but affects people to a great extent.
Do we know what causes narcolepsy?
The short answer is no, we don't. There is various types of various stages of sleep, as most people know, and REM sleep is one peculiar stage of sleep, the rapid eye movement sleep. This is the dream sleep when people mostly experience dream states. So there is an interesting phenomenon during REM sleep that our muscle tone decreases tremendously. We believe that this is the reason behind that is so we don't act out our dreams. It would be dangerous and problematic if we start acting what we dream. So our muscles, with the exception of the breathing muscles and some of the eye muscles, are actually paralyzed during REM sleep. Now, we believe that narcolepsy to some extent represents intrusion of REM sleep into wakefulness. So the sleepiness would be a sign of sleep when we are quote-unquote awake. The cataplexy that I described, this sudden loss of muscle tone, is also representative of what we should be seeing during REM sleep and not during wakefulness. There's also another interesting phenomenon in narcolepsy that we call hypnagogic hallucinations. Those are hallucinations, so seeing vivid images when somebody is drowsy, falling asleep or waking up. Again, this is what we would be doing when we are in REM sleep, dreaming. The only difference is we are doing it when we are awake. And last but not least, there is this very often scary phenomenon of sleep paralysis. This is when somebody is, again, drowsy, waking up in the morning, and they are paralyzed. This can really be a frightening experience. It is not just lack of energy. I don't feel like getting up. You wake up and you are actually paralyzed. You can't move. Again, another intrusion of REM sleep into wakefulness state where it shouldn't be.
It sounds like you have picked a very mysterious specialty for your career. Now, we talked at the beginning of the show about not exactly knowing why we sleep. In your estimation, Dr. Boris Medarov, why do we dream?
You got me there, Ray. This is an open question. It has been an open question for a long time. There are many theories, and as little as we know why we sleep, we know probably even less why we dream. Maybe we relive certain experiences during the day. There is theories that dreaming helps with reworking and processing the memory from the previous day and helps with learning and memory. We don't know, as unfortunate as it is, this is the answer to your question. We don't know.
All right. Dr. Boris Medarov is our guest. We'll take a quick break here, and then we'll recharge, and we'll come back, and we'll take your calls. It's Medical Monday. We talk sleep disorders today. Your calls coming up. It's a Medical Monday. Ray Graff with you. The number here is 800-348-2551. We're joined today by Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. And, Doctor, a couple of emails that have come in, and then we'll hit the phones. This one is from Deborah. Can you give your thoughts and opinion on Inspire treatment for severe sleep apnea, the risks, etc.? And you and I talked a little about this earlier. Tell us what the Inspire treatment is and what you think about it.
So the Inspire system is a relatively new modality, a surgical treatment option that's been around for several years now. It consists of a implantable device that's placed under the skin, usually on the right side of the chest, with two wires. One wire senses the breathing movements from the chest muscles, and the other wire sends a signal to a nerve under the chin that innervates the most important muscle that has a role in sleep apnea. So what it does is, with every breath, it stimulates this muscle under the chin, which prevents, or theoretically should prevent, the collapse of the airway, which is what sleep apnea is. It works in most cases. There is a relatively strict set of requirements who is a good candidate for the Inspire system. The severity of the disease should be within a certain range. The body mass index should be within a certain range. So it's not the right treatment for everybody. And it's a surgical procedure that's done in the operating room under anesthesia. Needless to say, it comes with a certain risk. In the right case, it can be very helpful. And for people who cannot tolerate CPAP or not interested in using CPAP for whatever reason, it could be a reasonable option.
This email from Ben in Gilderland. Interesting question from Ben. What is the science on diversity of circadian rhythms? A friend and I both claim that we naturally don't feel tired until midnight or 1 a.m. and would ideally sleep from 1 to 9. But another friend claims that we can just train ourselves to sleep earlier. It's not working. Is it possible we naturally just have slightly later circadian rhythm than our friend? Perhaps the world should accommodate different types of circadian rhythms.
Oh, another great question. And I think your caller is right. There is a fairly well-defined genetic predisposition to the various phenotypes, as we call them, in terms of our circadian rhythm. There are people who are night owls by design, by genetics, and there are people who are morning larks by design. You can train your ability to stay up at night or get up in the early to some extent, but you can't really change the inner predisposition to which type you are. And should we try to accommodate those people? Yes, I think we should. And I think one common issue that comes up often is that children very often are not happy to, let me put it this way, wake up early during the day. As we age, waking up early in the morning becomes a more natural thing.
Tell me about it.
Years of work and probably the process of aging itself. But most kids are not like that. And very often, and obviously there are geographical differences, we create or we put in place a children's schedule at school, daycare, other places around our schedule, and we may be doing a disservice to them in some cases.
Before we get to the phones, one more question. According to Dr. Boris Medarov, how much sleep should we get a night?
So there is no magical number. Some people function very well on 6 hours of sleep. Some people need 9. Some people need 10. I would advise people to estimate their own needs and sleep as much or as little as they need. Nobody functions well on 4 hours, so there are limits to this range of variability within certain groups. So most people fool themselves if they think they can function on 4 hours. I would say 5 to 6 would be the bare minimum. And even in those cases, it would raise a red flag whether or not somebody may be sleep deprived. Sleeping more than 9-10 hours would also probably way outside of the acceptable range.
Why?
So I would say...
Why would sleeping 9 or 10 hours be a bad thing? Not that I've ever done it.
Well, there is some data that if we sleep too much, we don't live as long. Now, we have to be careful to point out that that doesn't necessarily mean causation, but there is well-defined, well-established data that there is an optimum time or number of hours below which and after which our longevity drops.
Interesting.
Now, again, I have to be careful because this is on average for large populations, and it doesn't mean that if 8 hours is the right time for you and 9 hours is for somebody else, that everybody should stick to those numbers. But we do know that sleeping too much and sleeping too little is associated with higher mortality. It's associated with more cardiovascular morbidity. Maybe it's not the more or less sleep that causes that, but rather some third factor that causes the higher mortality and at the same time causes more sleep. So again, we have to be careful that there is an association, not necessarily a causation, but it does exist. Those numbers are out there.
Dr. Boris Medarov joins us today. We talk sleep disorders on Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We go to John in Newburgh. John, you're on.
Thank you. Several years ago, I went into a sleep clinic for a sleep test, and I was interested in noting that after the test, the doctor primarily just concentrated on sleep apnea. He said, I don't see any sign of sleep apnea, blah, 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 and sent me on my way with a sheet on sleep hygiene. And none of it seemed to really help that much. And I later found relief through hypnosis. I was taught how to self-hypnotize myself and was able to find some relief that way. My question was, what other things do the sleep tests in labs test for besides sleep apnea? Because it seemed like what they were saying to me was, you don't have sleep apnea, you don't need a BPAP machine, we can't sell you one, see you later.
Your question is very well taken, because this is a common scenario. Indeed, the traditional sleep study of polysomnography, as we call it, is an excellent tool to diagnose sleep apnea. Now, it does provide additional information, but very often its main value is in ruling out or grading the severity of sleep apnea. But to answer your question, there are other sleep disorders that we can detect on the sleep study. We can see how fragmented somebody's sleep is, how often one wakes up and falls back asleep, how long it takes to fall asleep. Going back to our original discussion of insomnia, difficulties falling or maintaining asleep. There are certain movement disorders. One relatively common disorder that we look for on the sleep study, which is called the periodic limb movement in sleep, is something that's diagnosed on the sleep study. There are sleep studies that are done during the day to evaluate the sleep latency, how sleepy somebody is. We talked a little bit about narcolepsy earlier. The way to diagnose narcolepsy and diagnose sleepiness related disorders would be with a daytime sleep study, measuring mostly how long it takes to get into REM sleep and how long it takes to fall asleep. I hope that answers your question, but I'm not surprised at your experience, because very often the sleep apnea is the main focus of the regular nighttime sleep study. Yes.
John, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday today, sleep disorders with Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. The number is 800-348-2551. Hope is in Albany. Hope, you're up.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So for the past few years, I've been having night terrors, and I used to have these as a kid, and it obviously affects my sleep patterns and also my partner's sleep a lot. And I've seen psychiatrists in the past in my primary care about it, but they've only suggested like benzodiazepines or sleep medication, and I feel resistant to taking that. I was wondering with the previous caller if you suggest taking a sleep study or other treatments if you know of?
So I would suggest you saw a sleep specialist, because your problem is not common. Sleep terrors are similar to sleepwalking, sleep talking. Those are common things during childhood. Almost everybody, with some exceptions, of course, grow out of those as we age. There are ways of dealing with slow wave sleep disorders, which night terrors belong to, outside of medications. Benzodiazepines are a good tool, but your reluctance to take benzodiazepines is obviously completely understandable. It's a complex issue that I'm afraid I can give you an easy solution in 15 seconds, but it probably will be helpful to know that this is not a disorder that will affect you, your health long term. Is not going to affect your longevity as much as it could be a source of distress to you or your bed partner. It's more of a nuisance than a real disease. I can offer you this much reassurance, at least.
Hope, thank you very much for the call. It's Medical Monday on WAMC. Our guest today is Dr. Boris Medarov, Medical Director of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. Our number is 800-348-2551. We go to Jim in Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
What is the role of inflammation in restless leg syndrome?
The role of inflammation in restless leg syndrome.
So restless leg syndrome is a group of disorders, if you will, that can have a different background. It's not considered typically an inflammatory disorder. It can be idiopathic, meaning it occurs for no reason. A lack of iron is one of the well-known secondary causes of restless leg syndrome. It's usually considered a good idea to check iron levels in everybody who has restless leg syndrome. But to answer your question, is it's not typically considered an inflammatory syndrome that should be treated with anti-inflammatory agents.
Jim, thanks very much for the call. Edward is in North Adams. Edward, you're on.
Hi. I'm 86 years old. I've been blind for 80 years. And I know that that has a influence on the biological clock. My question, first of all, let me tell you that right now I'm feeling quite alert and awake, yet I have not been asleep since Saturday night at midnight or so. So that's like, I don't know, 60 hours or something. My question is, are there any new studies, therapies, or ways to approach this 80-year-old sleep problem?
So you're suffering from what we call a non-24 syndrome, a non-24-hour sleep disorder. It's common in people who have impaired vision. And the issue in this problem is that even though the 24-hour cycle is in a way hardwired in our brain, it requires constant entraining by environmental cues, by the outside light. So for people with impaired vision or for there have been cases documenting people who ended up in caves for long periods of time. We know that without the environmental cues, our circadian cycle tends to run a little longer than 24 hours. And if you don't have the environmental cues to intermittently entrain that, you can get this free-running cycle or irregular cycle. Now, to answer your question how to deal with that, there are medications. They are basically melatonin-related, or even the good old melatonin is used for this purpose, taken on a regular basis to maintain your biological clock. Another helpful thing that sometimes is recommended and can be of use is to structure your activities around the 24-hour cycle. So even though your circadian clock may not know what time it is, but let's say all meals, activities, let's say you listen to music or you listen to audiobooks, structure those that they are at the same time every day, and those will be the environmental cues to your brain as to what time it is, and it's not going to be the light that it is for the average person.
Edward.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you very much for the call. And I'll tell you what, let's grab one more call, and then we'll take a short break. We're joined today by Dr. Boris Medarov, and Jim is in Saratoga. Jim, you're on.
Hey, yeah. I'm actually calling about my wife. So she falls asleep right away, and I'm more of a night owl. So I'm sitting there while she's sleeping, perfectly normal, breathing. You know, she's quiet and breathing. And suddenly she'll startle awake, bolt upright, and gasping for air, and thinking that her heart stopped or she stopped breathing. Now, she's been and had those sleep studies. She's had a couple of them over the years. And they say, no, you don't have sleep apnea. You don't need CPAP. But they won't tell her what she has. Any idea what this is and what can be done about it?
So assuming that the sleep studies indeed did not show any sleep apnea, the only thing I can think of off the top of my head would be what we call sleep jerks. Those are relatively... those are completely benign phenomena that a lot of people experience intermittently. This is a sudden jerk of all the muscles and sometimes can wake the person up. She may have that. There is another thing to keep in mind. Sleep apnea is a spectrum. Everybody has some degree of sleep apnea, and it has to exceed a certain level for us to consider it a condition. You don't fall off the cliff from a normal state into sleep apnea. It's a progressive spectrum. So it is possible that your wife has occasional sleep apnea episodes. We consider up to 5 of those per hour normal. That wouldn't qualify her problem as sleep apnea, but she can have still occasionally moments like that. So that would be another possible explanation.
Jim, we got to take a break here. We're joined today by Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. This is Medical Monday. The number is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. It's Vox Pop, Medical Monday. Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med Sleep Clinic joins us today, and our number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And Dr. Medarov, Natalie writes, we are very frustrated with the lack of information on the Respironics recall. We have been told just don't use it, which is simply impossible. How dangerous is using the machine? Have you any updates on when replacements will be shipped? I have not heard of this. Explain.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm getting this question because it's been out there and has been a source of anxiety to a lot of people. Philips Respironics is one of the two big manufacturers of CPAP in the United States. It's like having Honda and Toyota producing all the cars in the country, and all of a sudden one of those two manufacturers stops producing and recalls every single car that's been in production in the past several years. In a way, this is what's happening today with Philips Respironics. A lot of their models from the past several years have been recalled. The reason for that is there is foam inside the device that in some cases has been found to make its way into the circulation system, and small particles of that foam can end up in the respiratory system of the person. Now, nobody has been documented to have gotten hurt by that. It is a preventative action by the manufacturer. It has been a large-scale endeavor. There are millions of devices, and keep in mind, this is not just the United States. Philips Respironics is a major manufacturer across the globe. Now, on a more specific level, what does one do if they have a Philips Respironics and they receive a letter that their device is under recall? Register your device, which you probably have done. So when the time comes, you will either receive a new one or they will repair it. For the time being, if you have anything but a mild case, you probably should not stop using your device. What I would recommend as a temporary patch is If you go on Amazon, there are other online retailers that you can get those filters from. Microbacterial filters. There are small filters that cost a few dollars a piece. They can be placed between the tubing of the CPAP and the CPAP device. They are designed to filter out bacteria or moisture in some cases. But in this particular case, you would use it to prevent any small foam particles getting into the tubing. That will be a relatively safe temporary fix. And I would suggest you just did that until Philips replaces your device.
Will that require a reset of the back pressure on the machine? In other words, an extra filter level on that?
Okay. Another excellent question.
Sorry.
I'm glad you're asking that. There is no good way to predict, since those filters are not necessarily well controlled, how much of a resistance they introduce. One can make the argument to increase the pressure slightly, but that introduces impractical, difficult to accomplish step. The user cannot adjust the pressure. It's not user adjustable. So that would require every single device to be taken to the vendor for readjustment. And increasing the pressure by 1 or 2 centimeters of water may make the process ideal, but leaving it the way it is will probably be a feasible way of temporarily dealing with this issue, as opposed to simply stopping it. And unfortunately, in this environment that we live nowadays, the manufacturers are worried about legal actions, and they can tell you continue using it. But on the other hand, as a medical professional, I look at it from different angles. You have a severe sleep apnea. The risk of not using your CPAP device is very real. The risk of getting a small particle of the foam is more theoretical. So it becomes a trade-off between risks and benefits.
The lesser of two evils.
Exactly.
One more email here, Dr. Medarov, and then we'll go back to the phones. This one's from Jay, and it's also about a CPAP machine. And subject heading, central apnea. I have both obstructive and central sleep apnea. A CPAP brought the incidence from 56 per hour down to 3 to 5 an hour. Does the CPAP help with central apnea, and is a BPAP or APAP better for central apnea?
So if your index is below 5, I would consider this ideal control of your sleep apnea. I wouldn't worry about it, whether those residual few episodes are central or obstructive. Our goal, and this is what's considered normal in people without sleep apnea, a number below 5 is completely normal. Now, central apnea can be a primary disorder or can be a secondary disorder that we see in obstructive sleep apnea. So it really makes a difference whether one has those few central episodes that we call complex sleep apnea as part of obstructive sleep apnea, or it is a primary sleep apnea disorders. Now, those are extremely rare. Just purely statistically speaking, the chances of, again, I have to introduce my disclaimer over here that I can't treat you on the radio.
Of course.
But statistically speaking, for you to have a central sleep disorder, a central sleep apnea disorder, extremely, extremely unlikely. And if you have been diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, this is probably what we call a complex sleep apnea, and it is part of this obstructive sleep apnea syndrome.
We're joined today by Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med Sleep Clinic. The number is 800-348-2551. Back to the phones. Chad in Southampton. Chad, you're on.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Doctor, I have for quite some time been suffering with a bit of lack of sleep. In years past, it was falling asleep, but in more recent years, I do fall asleep very easily and very well for about 4 to 5 hours, and then I awake and am very restless for the remainder of 3 or so hours of my night. Doctors have prescribed medication, which I've taken for a bit of time but don't like to, and melatonin hasn't seemed to help me and certainly makes me feel quite groggy in the morning. Any ideas?
That's... This is what we call maintenance insomnia, a very difficult problem to tackle. There are many potential factors that can be contributing to it or causing this. One cluster of conditions that we always think of if somebody has difficulty maintaining sleep and not so much falling asleep would be depressive disorders, depression. Not to say that that has to be the case with you, but something to keep in mind. Medications can interfere with sleep and can cause that. Medical conditions, poor sleep, hygiene, circadian problems. Unfortunately, the list is very long. And I have to agree with you. There is no silver bullet. It's not an easy thing to treat. And using sleeping aids sometimes can help, but they come with come at a price. They can be addictive, and people develop tolerance to sleeping aids. You probably need good evaluation and see a sleep specialist if you haven't.
Chad, thank you very much for the call. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Hi, I'm 73 and three quarters. I have long-term sleep problems. Complex difficulty falling asleep, staying asleep, daytime drowsiness. The daytime drowsiness has gotten worse over the last few months, which more or less coincided with COVID vaccine. I understand drowsiness and brain fog are potential side effects. So I have two questions. How widespread is relative long-term, several months, that effect? And second, I have some melatonin, which I hope would keep me from waking up in the middle of the night. What's an appropriate dose? The smallest dose I could find was 10 milligrams.
So melatonin is considered a nutritional supplement, so it's not FDA regulated, and you can find it in a variety of amounts and doses. The actual effective agent in every pill is not monitored the same way as it is with FDA regulated substances. So very often it's anybody's guess what you get. To answer your question, is there is some data that anything above 100 micrograms of melatonin provides pretty much the same effect. Since again the amount in a particular brand is not necessarily clear despite what it says, I would say 2-3 milligrams is probably a reasonable dose. Going above that would not offer any additional benefit. So if that answers your question, 2-3 milligrams. And
the smallest dose I could find was 10 milligrams. And is there any...
Oh yes.
Is that too high?
I would say 10 milligrams is probably the highest dose that's on the market. There are 3, 5 milligrams, 2 milligrams. If you look around, you'll find it. They are relatively common.
Mark, thanks a lot. To Joan in Schenectady. Joan, you're on.
Thanks very much. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
And greetings, Doctor. I appreciated the information you both presented at the beginning of the program. I have a question about how do you know if a lot of sleep has become too much sleep?
So, greetings to you as well.
Thank you.
The way you would know would typically be if you, let's say you take a nap. If you take a nap and you wake up and you feel refreshed and ready to go, you know that was a good nap. You take a two-hour mm-hmm. nap and you wake up and you feel groggy and you feel like you haven't slept the whole day and you have less energy than what you had before, you know that nap mm-hmm. wasn't your friend. And this is probably true for the overall number of sleep hours at night as well. But specifically during the day, I alluded earlier about the optimal number of hours that too much sleep may not be a good thing. But there is data, similar data, that applies to daytime naps. Naps are probably a good thing as long as you keep them short. But too long naps, similarly to too many hours of overall sleep, are associated with higher mortality. So since there is no magical way to know what's optimal for a certain person, I would listen to your body. Just look at the way you feel after a nap, and they will tell you whether it was too much.
Joan, thanks a lot. We only have a couple of minutes left here with Dr. Boris Medarov. We go now to Joe in Albany. Joe, you're on.
Hi, yes. Thank you for having me. So in 2000, I joined the military. 2007, I was diagnosed with sleep apnea. 2009, I had a triple P sleep apnea surgery. 6 months later, I was back on the machine. My number is 11. Fast forward to right now, I just had a turbine reduction done to kind of help out with that. I'm a side sleeper. No one in my family has this, and I'm 181 pounds, so it's kind of rare for me to have that. They think it's contributed to environmental exposures, being out in the desert, one of the few times I was out there. So my question is, I have a couple of questions. The first one is, am I permanently on this machine for the rest of my life? Is there any other treatments that I can take and do that can kind of get me off this? The second one is, also, I don't dream anymore. So if I fall asleep without the mask on, or since I'm a side sleeper and the mask falls off, then I'll have dreams. But when it's on, I don't dream. And so I guess that's the two for now.
Okay. Well, we only have about a minute here left, Joe. So let's see how doctor does.
So I'll try to be quick with this. It really depends if 11 is your index with or without the CPAP. But the truth is you probably don't have any other reasonable treatment options besides the CPAP after having had surgery already. Inspire system may be something you may want to look into and consider if you're willing to subject yourself to an invasive procedure again. There would be an option. But keep in mind, that's going to be my last word, index of 11 is actually fairly low.
Joe.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Now, we only have 30 seconds here, doctor. This email from Peter. I have a recurring dream that I have insomnia. I wake up very tired. That's it.
I'm sorry. I have a dream that I have insomnia.
I have a recurring dream that I have insomnia, and I wake up very tired. That's from Peter. Is that really a thing?
It's having a dream about having a sleeping problem.
Yeah, all right.
Well. And there is no diagnosis that I'm aware of. Peter, look for a professional opinion.
All right. Hey, Dr. Boris Medarov, great job. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Ray.
Support comes from Drs. Sarcino and McGuire, podiatrists with offices in Greenwich, New York, and Bennington, Vermont. Surgery for the foot and ankle, nyfootsurge.com for more information. Once again, thanks to Dr. Boris Medarov of Albany Med for joining us today. Thank you for listening. Thanks for the great calls. We have so many calls on hold, which, by the way, you can hang up now. I'm sorry, the show is over. We'll have to have Dr. Medarov back with us again in not too long a time. So hang in there. Try to get some sleep. We'll bring the doc back, and we'll answer your questions. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer, who only nodded off a couple times during the show. Well done, sir. Joe Makowitz screened the calls today. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, we're going to do a genealogy show. Now, it has been years since we have done one of those. So if you're barking up your family tree, genealogist Tracy Scrabbit will take your calls. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, stand by for the Media Project.